All right.
Please be seated. We are on the record in Latah County case CR-2005-2027. It's the State of Idaho versus Stephen James Sittler. Present are Mr. Thompson and Ms. Vowles. On behalf of the state, present with them is Mr. Douglas from probation and parole. Mr. Willenweber and Mr. Monson are present on behalf of Mr. Sittler. Mr. Sittler is present at council table with his attorneys. My calendar says this is a status conference. I've been through the file. I suspect that's erroneous. I know the defense seeks to reinstate Katie Sittler as a chaperone for her husband. That they seek to have, defense seeks to have the most recent safety plan authored by Valley Treatment Specialties adopted, an order beginning the reunification of the Sittler family and reinstating Grandfather David Sittler as a chaperone. I think there's a threshold matter that needs to be addressed, which was broached in Mr. Thompson's letter to me of August 8, 2016, questioning whether Mr. Monson has become a witness in this case. Mr. Thompson, would you like to be heard in that?
Well, Your Honor, I prefer to just let the letter speak for itself. I wanted to raise the issue because when I saw the active role that Mr. Monson was taking as a factual witness, that raised concerns in our office. We are always reluctant to raise these issues in any sort of formal fashion. That's why I did it by letter to Your Honor. We've not had any dialogue with either Mr. Monson or Mr. Willenweber on the substance of that. And I don't know if Mr. Monson plans to try to maintain both roles or what the intentions are, but I felt it was incumbent on us to at least bring it to Your Honor's attention.
Thank you. Mr. Monson.
Your Honor, first of all, I would note, I don't believe that there's a motion to disqualify me before the court.
I don't think there is.
Excuse me?
I don't think there is.
And so I'm prepared to address it. I appreciate Mr. Thompson allowing this, allowing the letter to stand. I guess by way of brief background, I did contact Brad Andrews at the Idaho State Bar. In my view, Mr. Thompson raised what I would term to be some sort of an ethical violation on my part based on this, and so I contacted Bar Counsel, number one, to find out if, in fact, I had crossed the line, and if so, I needed to report that, and secondly, if I had, I needed to figure out how to get out of it. I can represent to the court that after consulting with Mr. Andrews, he doesn't believe that 3.7 is implicated at this point. It's not a trial. Also, Your Honor, I guess I would point out, as far as I'm aware, the issue to which my affidavit speaks isn't the ultimate issue that we're talking about today. It was certainly just as I was there reporting factually what had happened. So Mr. Andrews doesn't think that that 3.7 is implicated at this point. And I'm happy to provide some additional information if Your Honor deems fit.
I generally defer to my good friend Brad Andrews in all things that pertain to the rules of professional responsibility. I think this is an evidentiary hearing, which is akin to a trial. I think Mr. Thompson's concern about being able to cross-examine is a valid concern. And I'm trying to figure out a way to maneuver this proceeding, both from the standpoint of fundamental fairness, but also within the bounds of the rules of professional responsibility. So I'm trying to figure it out. So I don't want you to hold back. So if you've got more you'd like to add, I'm prepared to hear it.
Well, Judge, I do. I know that as I researched the issue here, it relates to a trial. There are jurisdictions, and I was provided some information from Mr. Andrews as we discussed this. And there are other jurisdictions that distinguish between pre-trial, post-trial hearings, and an actual trial. Mr. Andrews also represented, because we're not in front of a jury, the purpose is not to confuse the trier of fact. I think if Your Honor reviews the affidavit, reviews what's in the affidavit, I don't think Your Honor will be confused as to what role the affidavit was meant to say. The other thing I would indicate, Your Honor, is there must be some sort of a nexus between what the issue here is and what's in the affidavit. The issue in front of you today relates to whether or not Mrs. Sittler and Mr. Dave Sittler ought to be reinstated as chaperones. The issues that were outlined in the affidavit simply relate to I was in attendance at these meetings with the probation officer. During those meetings, we were talking about what steps needed to happen before that this recertification could take place. I don't believe that there's a nexus between what happened in there and what the ultimate issue is here. The other thing I'd point out, Judge, as far as I'm aware, as I've reviewed the documents, I don't think that there's anything really contested in my affidavit. I certainly haven't seen anything in the filings that dispute. I don't think anybody's disputing that I was in attendance at those meetings. I don't think anybody's disputing the substance of what was talked about in those meetings. So as I tried to be as candid as I could with Mr. Andrews, I said, this was my purpose, this is the ultimate issue, and we discussed the idea that there needed to be some sort of nexus. Again, he does not think that Rule 3.7 is implicated in this particular case for the reason that we're not talking about a trial, and also for the reason that we're not talking about, we don't have a sufficient nexus. He also indicated with regard to my disqualification, I could be here and Mr. Wollenweber could advocate this morning, which is exactly what we expect to happen. Now, I will address an unrelated issue regarding the motions to seal, but as far as the substantive nature of today's hearing, Mr. Wollenweber is prepared to move forward on that.
Very well. Mr. Thompson, would you like to be heard in response?
Your Honor, I think the state's best course of action is to leave this in the discretion of Your Honor. We felt like we needed to raise it, and we trust Your Honor to make the appropriate decision if the defense's position is that Mr. Monson's affidavit isn't all that important. Perhaps the easiest way to handle it is just simply not consider it at all, and we eliminate the issue. But I leave this to the court's discretion. We are certainly not making any motion to disqualify Mr. Monson. We aren't asking for any affirmative relief. We just wanted to have the issue addressed.
Would you like to be heard in response?
No, Your Honor. I'll defer to what has been said already.
Well, as I alluded earlier, I'm deferential to Mr. Andrews when it comes to issues of professional responsibility. He operates within his realm of authority, and I operate in my realm of authority, and I guess to the extent that he thinks that 3.7 isn't implicated, it reduces my concerns substantially. I also think that, as Mr. Monson has pointed out, that it's much more important if this were to be tried before a jury, and having the jury sort things out when an advocate is acting as a witness tends to confuse matters. I think I can keep those straight. So I think I have addressed the issue, and I'm going to move on.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Wollenweber, would you like to proceed at this juncture, or how would you like to proceed?
If it pleases the court.
It may.
I believe the court has aptly summarized the fourfold issue raised by the defense for this morning. I know you will hear the echoes of the September 1, 2015 hearing, of which, in a certain sense, we are here today to revisit and to continue. The parties, and by parties I particularly mean Mr. Sittler and or versus probation and parole, are in need of the assistance of the court. That's why the formal motion and the host of affidavits were submitted. as a footnote, I'd point out that there are no facts set out in the Attorney Monson affidavit that are contested. Indeed, I believe there are no facts contested for the purposes of this hearing. The only submission that we received under oath that contains any facts whatsoever was received not quite 24 hours ago, signed by Mr. Douglas in the form of a letter to you. And therein, nothing that Mr. Monson said, or that Katie Sittler said, or that Stephen Sittler said, or that Dr. Greg Wilson said is contradicted or contested in any way. That in and of itself is a great leap forward from last year. Nevertheless, we need the assistance of the court, or we certainly did in a dire sense up till 24 hours ago, because the VTS, Valley Treatment Services, expressly articulated in a letter, which was a third draft letter to the court, dated April 25 and date stamped April 29. I speak with specificity because there's more than one filing under that date. A plan and a recommendation that these specialists in sex offense cases were making in the context of Mrs. Katie Sittler being reinstated as a chaperone, and the family of Stephen Sittler, Katie Sittler, and the baby beginning to be reunified. Up until 24 hours ago, the state, and when I say the state, I mean probation and parole, or the IDOC, had for several months worked showing a tendency toward agreeing with the court's implicit statements or inferred statements or implied statements last September 1st, that at some point, with appropriate retraining, that particular mother and wife, in all likelihood, would be reinstated as a chaperone, which is, of course, critical to the 24/7 operation of this little family. Probation and parole reversed that position and simply said on July 6th, no, Mrs. Sittler, Mrs. Katie Sittler, you will not be reinstated. You cannot be reinstated because no one else has been in that situation before. That is where they had been suspended or whatever the word would be. Thankfully, and I am thankful for, 24 hours ago, in substance, now, probation and parole says, with one exception that I'll speak to in just a moment, we can indeed begin this process with the one exception that we'll talk about. So, you'll be happy to know I'm moving about 60-65% through my brief to later points. We think the three polygraphs that are talked about in detail, and the language of which is before you, are critical. Those reports show deep, intense scrutiny of Mr. Sittler's life, activities, thought life. He's passed all of those polygraph tests. Dr. Wilson has agreed in substance with the VTS recommendation, and so I pause to point out that the two entities, VTS and Dr. Wilson, who are competent, who have some competence in this field of sex offense and reunification, have spoken in favor both of Katie being reinstated as a chaperone and the family beginning a reunification process. No matter how much goodwill all the rest of us have, and no doubt there is some goodwill in all of us in connection with this matter, we are not competent in the way that David Nystrom, Crystal Wren, and Dr. Gregory Wilson are. There is no countervailing voice against those competent people. This is no doubt, happy for you, not a situation where you have dueling experts. We have only one voice, and it is speaking in favor of reinstatement and reunification of the family. A couple of points regarding the protection and good order of society, which I'm sure is uppermost in the court's mind, and I'm sure is uppermost in the prosecution's mind, and surely is very high in the mind of probation and parole. Their filings that were not under oath, but by way of notes and memos and that kind of thing, emails, and our filings, which have to do with statements during meetings. And if I may take a footnote, you know, there is not 100% level of trust on either side of this equation. That's one of the reasons we're before you today. Now, had we received this a couple months ago, maybe we wouldn't even be here today. Maybe things could have been worked out. I don't know. But I have personally been in communication early on in this matter where we said we want to have a tape recorder present at the meetings with probation and parole officers. And at first we said, they said, okay, as long as it's on the tape, as long as we know it's there. And then after a couple of meetings in my presence, I didn't swear an affidavit, but Mr. Monson did at the October 28 meeting last year. No, we don't want to have the tape recorder anymore. We're taking notes, the defense was assured. Well, we've found any number of times when those notes are not consistent with what was said at the meetings. That's why Mr. Monson attended the meetings in the first place and then filed what really is kind of a housekeeping affidavit as to who was there and who said what, none of which is contested at this hearing. A couple of important things are, since late September or October 1st of last year, probation and parole, speaking through Ms. Chris Jensen, said the goal of probation and parole was reunification. Moreover, she gave some of the rationale, which those of us who participate in or near the criminal system know, that a person in Mr. Sittler's situation are subject to a host of very substantial difficulties, or what they call triggers, stress, isolation, amongst others, being cut off from at least substantial contact on a regular basis with his family, and that those triggers need to be reduced for the good of society. Now, of course, it would be for the good of Mr. Sittler, too, but chiefly the probation and parole was speaking to us, and my eyes lit up when I heard what is common sense. The reunification of the family under appropriate circumstances is best for society because it reduces those substantial pressures on the particular probationer. So, for the good of society, separate and apart from anything having to do with Sittler's, after 11 months, and given the nearly 9-year trajectory of the case, we think this is the time. And Mr. Douglas almost agrees, but he adds a caveat. He says, there are some very important questions. And I, Mr. Douglas, feel I must have the answers to these questions via polygraph in connection with what people saw or thought or heard last August and September of 2015. We couldn't disagree more. Now, I hasten to add, polygraphs for a chaperone as to what's happening at present and into the future, that's part of what they sign up for. We agree that if a reunification begins now, and if Mrs. Katie Sittler is reinstated, they could ask for her polygraph next week or next month in connection with what had happened presently. But it's not just and it's not fair for probation and parole, who was acutely aware of everything that was said to Mr. Pulver I'm just going to say on or shortly before September 1st, 2015, they had it in summary form in his report. They had a video of the entire interview that I believe Your Honor watched all or most parts of. And they had a transcript of the last 7 minutes, which were, we thought, most important, so we had it transcribed. That they could have said, gee, this raises questions about what Katie knew in the last 2 to 4 to 6 weeks. But they did not ask for a polygraph of her in September, October, November, December, and on all the way until 24 hours ago. And now he says, well, I think we're getting there, but I have to have answers to what somebody was thinking or hearing or seeing 12 months ago, 13 months ago, 11 months ago. That's asking too much of a polygraph. It's barely built to pick up things that are happening presently, or dramatic things, like did you have you robbed a bank, you know, in the last 5 years? That would be a dramatic thing. But as to what day of the week it was, or approximately what week it was that you heard Stephen say something about his thought life, that's not fair. That's not just. We disagree with that and must have the court's assistance. Obviously, we'll abide with whatever the court rules. It's an important case to both sides of the aisle. For whatever reasons, the Department of Correction / PNP had all the information they need from BTS in April. They themselves, as our filings show, and as their own notes, emails, and letters show, participated in the modification and finishing of the BTS safety plan and recommendation for reinstatement. If the court simply is to order that Mrs. Katie Sittler is reinstated as a chaperone under all the conditions that are part of the BTS letter and part of her chaperone agreement that she signs on to, with amongst other elements of that signing on, polygraphs in the future in connection with what's happening with Mr. Stephen Sittler in his actions and his thoughts presently and into the future, we think that's exactly where we should go. That's exactly what the status should become. That 11 months is enough, that for whatever reason, satisfactory to themselves, they took no action in connection with Katie Sittler. She asked to come and meet with Chris Jensen. She followed it up with a letter. She followed that up with an email. Never got a response. This was last November. Meanwhile, concerned members of the community wrote and or emailed to Ms. Jensen, and those were answered within a week or 10 days. But Mrs. Katie Sittler got no response whatsoever from that particular person who was on this case for about 6 months, nor from any other probation and parole person. And as you know, when Mrs. Katie Sittler and her husband drove from Moscow down to Lewiston to meet with the new probation officer, in whom we have very substantial confidence, they were met at the door and said, no, there's to be no meeting. Because the other side of the matter was stonewalling now. Having put Katie through the BTS process twice, not just once, but twice, two meetings in the fall, two meetings in the early spring, then they said, we can't even meet with you. So we beg your intervention in this matter. As to Mr. Dave Sittler, he also has gone through the retraining required and requested by probation and parole and conducted by BTS. That was many months ago. I'm drawing a blank on exactly which month.
November.
Yeah. Early November 2015. He hasn't received a call yet because they're stonewalling. it'd be most productive for our side not to speculate on the motivations as to why that position is taken. But that is their position. So I have the same comment regarding Mr. Dave Sittler. Polygraphs are part of the deal for him when he signs up. But here, what Mr. Douglas said 24 hours ago for the very first time is, I think I have to have a polygraph of Dave Sittler as to what he heard and saw, I think it was 3 years before last September, the event of the river where Mr. Steven Sittler saw a young woman across the river, no contact, etc. And Mr. Steven Sittler at that time was not in treatment with ETS. We are, you know, we're engaging really and appropriately, I think, within certain parameters in thought police here. If Stephen has a thought, he is to express it, and he has indeed done so. So as to the present and the future, it seems to me reasonable, if it's conducted reasonably, and if Mr. Douglas wants to know what Mr. Dave Sittler has heard in the last month, say, if this reinstatement occurs, I think that's completely appropriate. But to ask Mr. Sittler now, after the agency that says it's important to know has sat on their hands for 11 months, I don't think that's just, and I don't think that's fair. We object to that. So on September 1, 2015, the court and counsel had colloquy regarding Mrs. Katie Sittler, and the expectation, I believe, of everybody in the room was that at some point, reasonably, with retraining, in all likelihood, reinstatement likely would occur. And there was discussion or colloquy between the court and counsel regarding the grandparents of the baby, that is Mr. Steven Sittler's parents. One has been reinstated. The other has had no communication from the controlling agency in many months. Just a moment, Judge.
You may.
Oh, and the third issue where there was colloquy between the court and counsel. If there came a situation where the defense felt reasonably that there was something not appropriate happening under probation parole, the eyes and ears of the court and the feet on the ground of the court, that we were to repair to the court for its assistance, and that's exactly what we're doing. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Wollenweber. Mr. Thompson?
Thank you, Your Honor. Initially, in response to Mr. Wollenweber's statements to the court, it's the state's position that the parties are not in need of the court's intervention. The position of the Department of Correction is, I believe, pretty clearly outlined in Mr. Douglas's submission. As I represented to the court, as counsel know, Mr. Douglas has been gone for the past 2 weeks, the time during which the defense filed all of their voluminous filings and motions and requests specifying what they wanted to do. So this is simply the first opportunity this week to respond. Mr. Douglas did that promptly upon his return to his office. And I also want to address right up front the representations about what occurred on July 6th when the Sittlers were told, okay, well, we aren't going to talk about this anymore. It's important to remember that that was just following when Sittler's counsel filed with the court to bring issues back before the court, and the department was reacting to the fact that we now had pending litigation, and it was reasonable to have it resolved through the attorneys and not privately. Whether that was a good decision or not, that's just the way things worked out, Judge. And the timing supports that, because the filing on the request for the status hearing was on June 28th, a good week before that meeting. Substantively, the state has two responses. And I want to be clear that these responses aren't necessarily completely in line with each other. First response is on behalf of the Department of Correction and Probation and Parole.
Mr. Douglas's case plan that was filed early yesterday morning outlines what his intentions are, what his plan has been. It is reasonable in what it is proposing, particularly given the serious history of this case, the serious nature of Mr. Sittler's pedophilia, the serious risk that we need to be concerned about for his child, complicated all the more so by the disclosures from last summer that I'm sure Your Honor still remembers, that gave grave concern to everyone as far as Mr. Sittler's thoughts and physical actions with his own child. The Department of Correction has not foreclosed reinstatement and in fact has a plan that they would like to pursue for that. The request for polygraphs, Your Honor, is consistent logically with that. Mr. Douglas needs to assess what sort of risk do these two individuals pose as chaperones before he can in good conscience reinstate them. And if I could hand the court what's been marked as State's Exhibit Number 1, the defense has a copy of this. These are IDOC sex offender chaperone agreements signed last November by David Sittler, Roxanne Sittler, and Katie Sittler. And I direct the court to condition number 11 that says, I understand that in special circumstances, if I want to maintain my status as a chaperone, I may be asked to participate in taking and passing a polygraph regarding the issue at my own expense. And I will concede that they have not been reinstated, but they were chaperones. They were suspended and terminated from their chaperone status. But the polygraph not only is reasonable factually, the polygraph is something that they contemplated when they signed these documents last November. And there's a legitimate basis for the department to be able to vet their chaperones, particularly in this case with the close family relations of these proposed chaperones. I would also like to point out that it is the Department of Correction here who has the statutory responsibility and authority to supervise. Idaho Code 20-219 specifically directs that it is the Department of Correction to address supervision issues, including contact restrictions. It is not the call of Valley Treatment Specialties. It is not the call of Dr. Wilson, and it is certainly not the call of Mr. Sittler to decide who his chaperones are going to be, when the reunification occurs. Those are calls that legally are vested exclusively with the Department of Correction. Unfortunately, the history in this case is that whenever Mr. Sittler doesn't get what he wants, he comes running to the court, asking the court to excuse him from complying with what the Department of Correction expects of him as his supervisors. It's been going on since he went on probation in 2007. The state finds it interesting that Mr. Sittler wants to point back to statements made in this court last September about the possible reinstatement of chaperones and reunification, when in fact, Mr. Sittler also wants to completely disregard the statements made in this courtroom on June 1st, 2011. This situation is entirely of Mr. Sittler's creation. He and his wife and family were put on clear notice back in 2011 that were they to have a child, Mr. Sittler would be expected to leave the family home. And I go back to the transcript of that hearing, which I think the court has been referenced to in the past, and the court's own statements. And this came from probation. There was testimony from probation and parole. There was an acknowledgement from Mr. Willenweber that the introduction of a child would have ramifications. There were state representations by myself. Mr. Sittler was advised, if and when Mr. Sittler and Ms. Travis have children, we will cross that bridge when we get to it. Or if we need to address it sooner than that, I'm happy to address it sooner than that. But I think it's a reasonable restriction that he not reside with his wife and child in the future if, in fact, they have children. With that knowledge, with that expectation, these are going to be my words, my characterization, the Department of Corrections characterization, Mr. Sittler irresponsibly and recklessly brought this child, this innocent child, into this untenable situation. But for him to claim it's somehow the state's fault, that we have to solve his problem for him, is not appropriate. He knew what was coming, Judge. And once again, he wants it his way. And he will complain until he gets it his way. So the state doesn't have any sympathy for Mr. Sittler. We certainly have sympathy and concern for his child. And I would suggest, Your Honor, that the state's concerns are not speculative. If you look at the C notes that were appended to the filings, Bates stamp number page 243, this is regarding a June 22nd, 2016 meeting that Mr. Sittler had with the probation office. So Bates stamp 243 at the bottom. They were discussing chaperones and the reinstatement of chaperones. And according to the C notes, the defendant became defensive when I tried to explain to him the protective factors regarding the future situations that may arise with his son and potentially other children. Defendant states, it is not our job to protect his child. It is his, and his son will know who he is. He stated his children will not go to public schools as they will be homeschooled and never at risk from community influence. That is scary, Judge. That is a declaration that Mr. Sittler intends to hide his children from public scrutiny, from the protection that other eyes can give, isolating them for his own good, for his own protection, not for anything else. That is a legitimate concern. And then we look at Mrs. Katie Sittler's affidavit. And bless her, maybe she really didn't know what she was getting into with this. But it is clear from the tone of her affidavit, and I don't dispute that those are her words. They don't sound like a lawyer's words. And we both know lawyers tend to write affidavits for people or to help them with wording. But she does not trust at all probation and parole. She seriously minimizes what occurred last year and what was disclosed. She describes those events as, quote, the split-second chest incident, close quotes, and quote, the fleeting thoughts with no act associated with the baby's sucking, close quotes. She is substantially minimizing what happened. She is substantially minimizing where that behavior could have led to with their own child. And then she goes on to say, I'm looking at page 2 of her affidavit, if any of those things occurred today, I would see to it that Stephen immediately called DTS and I would call DTS. And she says that a couple times about calling DTS. What is noteworthy is nowhere does she say that she will notify probation and parole. And her obligation as a chaperone is not to notify DTS. Her obligation as a chaperone is to notify probation and parole. And frankly, Judge, this is understandable. We're talking about the man she married, her husband. No doubt in their wedding vows, they had respect for each other. They promised to protect each other. And she knows what's on the line for Mr. Sittler. If he screws up, he could go to prison for the rest of his life. Pretty high stakes when she compares them to what she sees as a a split-second chess incident, and fleeting thoughts with no act associated with the baby's sucking. So, Judge, the state is very concerned. We aren't trying to press point blame or press fault or say that Katie Sittler is a bad person. She is not. But she is in a completely untenable situation. And the department's caution in reconsidering her chaperone status is legitimate and factually and practically justified. I spoke a little bit about the history of the defendant's pattern of impatience. He wants it his way, right away, and if not, he'll make enough noise about it until he gets it his way, right away. And I looked back through the summary of C notes that was appended to the state's initial response to the defendant's motion in this case, Your Honor, and specifically noted an August 17, 2007 email from Steve Winsley, who, Your Honor, is aware, was the principal at Valley Treatment Specialties until he retired. This is August 7th, 2007. An email apparently sent to me, but copied to the department so it appears in their C notes. Bill, I read the email sent to you by Willenweber. It seems he wants to keep pushing an issue until he gets what he wants. We do not appreciate him trying to put the finger on VTS because probation and parole have placed restrictions on him, Stephen, they do not like. At this point, I'm going to talk with Dalton and David about whether or not we want to continue to work with Stephen in therapy. If we're going to constantly run up against these kinds of issues, then it might be time to have him go elsewhere. What Willenweber and his family don't seem to realize is that Stephen is a fixed pedophile and is at very high risk. Their lack of real cooperation and wanting to keep the secrecy issues going are helping to keep his risk high. They further do not be taking this as serious as they should be. And then the email goes on from there. This isn't new. This is 2007, Judge. Almost, well, 9 years ago, when Mr. Sittler was first going on probation. And the state is concerned that that mindset and that attitude hasn't changed, as evidenced by Mr. Sittler's own statements to his probation officer so recently that I just referred to, about isolating the family from the public eye, and from the safety that that can afford them. And I have to say, Judge, it's getting to the point where the state is more and more concerned that Mr. Sittler is behaving as though he's really not amenable to being safely supervised in the community. He resists at every instance when he disagrees with what he's being told with, despite the substantial risk factors, despite the substantial history of sexual abuse that he has committed. I was sitting yesterday kind of thinking about being here today and wondering, well, you know, if we had the situation as we know it today, and Mr. Sittler was just coming back from a rider at that point in time, what would we be looking at for a sentence? And I went and looked at the factors of Idaho 19-2521, subsection 2, that, as Your Honor is aware, are factors according weight in favor of avoiding a sentence of imprisonment. And I'm stunned to see how many of those factors the state believes the answer would be no if Your Honor were sentencing this man today. That the defendant's criminal conduct neither caused nor threatened harm. Not at all. It's not the case. Defendant did not contemplate that his conduct would cause or threaten harm. That factor doesn't exist. The defendant acted under a strong provocation. That factor does not exist. There were substantial grounds tending to excuse or justify the defendant's criminal conduct. That's not in existence in this case. The victims of the defendant's criminal conduct induced or facilitated the commission of the crime. Certainly not the case. The defendant has no history of prior delinquency or criminal activity, or has led a law-abiding life for a substantial period of time before the commission of the present crime, and we know that that's not the case. He had multiple victims over an extended period of time. That the defendant's criminal conduct was a result of circumstances unlikely to recur. The state would submit that's not the case. And finally, the character and attitudes of the defendant indicate that the commission of another crime is unlikely. And this is a man who, once again, regularly fights with his probation officer, is not willing to submit to their legal authority to supervise him, wants it his way all the time, every way. So that brings me to the state's position. I told Your Honor just a few minutes ago, we have two positions to articulate. And I will recognize up front that we provide legal counsel to the Department of Correction. We advise them. It is Scott Douglas's decision on what the department decides as to chaperones, reunification, supervision in general. That's his legal duty.
You're That's saying they're job. Your client.
They are my client for providing advice. But I also represent the people of the state of Idaho as the elected prosecutor of Latah County. And I think it is worthwhile to note, given what I've described, that I am extremely concerned that Katie Sittler cannot be put in the position of a chaperone in this case by herself.
Even though that's contrary to what Valley Treatment Specialties has suggested?
Yes.
And what basis do you have to contradict the, what I'll characterize as the experts?
For the reasons that I've stated, the concerns I have.
So did your personal concerns outweigh what the experts say?
No, Your Honor. In the end.
What evidence do you have?
Your determination. I am merely pointing out to the court facts that I don't see them taking adequate account of that cause the state concern that we are creating a situation for another victim.
If you had an expert voicing that view, that would be one thing. But I don't see any dispute on the facts.
And Your Honor, I would submit that you don't need an expert to consider common sense.
Well, let's go back to your recitation of the sentencing guidelines.
I think
it's safe to say that had you not entered into an agreement with Mr. Sittler to sentence him in the way that he was sentenced, he would have been sentenced dramatically differently.
Yes, sir, that is true.
So, much of what I see in this is what I will characterize as buyer's remorse. That after having agreed to a sentence and had that sentence implemented, there is now, I don't know if it's revisionist history, I don't know what it is, but there seems to be a change of view as regards the state's position vis-a-vis Mr. Sittler. And I'm trying to understand it, and I don't yet understand it.
No, Your Honor, that is a fair question because there is a change in the state's position in regard to Mr. Sittler, and that change occurred when he and his wife had this child and created this new situation that didn't exist. It wasn't even foreseen at the time this case was being dealt with a decade ago. That has changed. That's the state's concern now. Those were issues we didn't have before. And until the birth of this child and the concerns from last summer, the state didn't have issues. But because of what has happened since then, we now have serious issues. It's not buyer's remorse. Were it not for these intervening new factors that we had no knowledge of, that we did not anticipate, we wouldn't be here today. I appreciate Your Honor's concern, and I can appreciate the appearance, but this is not a case of buyer's remorse. The state, up to these new events, I believe, had maintained a position of support for the continuation of the probation. And at this point, we aren't suggesting the court do otherwise with the probation, but I think there are concerns that need to be mentioned. I would also mention, Your Honor, that when it comes to chaperones, it's not as though Mr. Sittler needs chaperones. This is exhibit number 2. Counsel also have a copy of this. This is a May 16th email of this year, May 16th, 2016, email from Mr. Monson to Monica Kalar with the Department of Correction, Mr. Sittler's current probation officer. And it lists 12 chaperones the defendant already has. It's not like there aren't approved chaperones out there. There's a plethora of chaperones out there. So, Your Honor, the bottom line is the state would ask that the court deny the defendant's motion. We believe it's unnecessary. We believe and submit that the Department of Correction is not in need of the court's guidance. The Department of Correction's plan is clear. The request for the polygraphs is justified and legitimate based on the facts that we know this. We would hope that Mr. Sittler can appreciate the fact that he is on probation for the rest of his life, that he needs to submit to supervision, he needs to stop fighting the supervision and try to work with his probation officers. We can't forget what the history is here. You have a diagnosed pedophile, multiple victims, probation for life, and he now has a child who is defenseless. And the state's concerned. We are concerned, and that is a new situation we did not have when this case first started. It's a new situation, realistically, we didn't have until just a little bit over a year ago, Judge. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wohnweber.
I'll try to take things in order that were just said. I don't disagree that PNP has to assess risks and vet chaperones. The fair way to do it, back in November when these documents were signed that counsel mentioned, is get them in and have them polygraphed. But don't sit on your hands and do nothing, and then 8, 9, 10 months later say, oh, we want to have a polygraph about what happened a year ago. That's not fairly vetting a chaperone. That's taking a reasonable rationale to paper over or cover over a wrongful handling of the matter. Mr. Sittler, and certainly I, have not been fighting with the probation officers. I disagree with that characterization. There certainly have been times when we've sought the court's assistance. Those times when we felt PNP was doing something unfairly or unjustly. Now I know that VTS criticized me in 2007, but notice the absence of criticism, lo, these 9 years. They're still on the case. You know they've been on the case every year since then. I've been on the case too. So apparently they and I are getting along. And they're the ones who authored the first draft of this safety plan. David Nystrom, one of the men named in that 2007 email, was the chief author. And he knows and knew and continues to know that I'm on the case. The only time that we have a problem is where something is done arbitrarily or unfairly, as has, in our opinion, occurred certainly since April. Stephen finished with VTS in March, Katie in April. It's now August 17th. Neither Stephen nor anybody at this table are seeking sympathy for Mr. Sittler. We're seeking fairness and just processing and action by PNP. Anybody who has ever questioned General Motors, the United States Army, Department of Probation and Parole, a large bureaucracy, is not a welcome voice. What's striking is what PNP's handling of this case says about the others. I would anecdotally hazard a guess that 90% of probationers don't have the wherewithal to hire counsel to review the notes, to go in and talk to the PNP officers. Instead, PNP has absolute, unfettered, unsupervised control of those people. And in this case, I think we're showing examples about how, on occasion, in the past, I'm not including the present probation officer in this matter, but there have been some occasions when there have been flip-flopping and unfairness. The mention of the June 2011 hearing, I think, is instructive. And I mentioned this in my original brief, so I can be shorter in my comments than I otherwise would have been. Probation and parole for months was supportive of the upcoming marriage, because Stephen had to get all sorts of permits to go get the, send out the invitations and to fly down to Fallon and to buy the ring and all of the things that go along with a marriage, all approved by PNP until 10 days to 2 weeks before the marriage. And then a concerned citizen or concerned citizens wrote letters to PNP and actually held meetings and obtained documents. PNP immediately changed then, and with days to go, sought to block the marriage. That was the context. And that's the context now today. Everything tended toward reinstatement of Katie and reunification until a concerned citizen's letter on June 14 was emailed to several people in this room. The defense did not have the benefit of it at that time, but it was clear that something had happened. And in the 1,000 pages of disclosure that we got 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, there's the concerned citizen's complaint to PNP about the way it apparently is handling the Sittler case. It's within that week is when the declaration was made to Mr. Sittler that reinstatement shouldn't occur because it hasn't happened in like cases. If Mr. Sittler or his family didn't have the wherewithal to question PNP, to have your assistance on occasion, it would be untenable for him. I think it's as unlikely today as it was September 15th, when the court in the colloquy itself mentioned or inferred that Katie Sittler or Dave Sittler would somehow choose Stephen over the baby. That's contrary to the experience of most of us, and it certainly would be contrary to Katie and to Dave. Well, I agree that this is not an easy case. It is not the hardest type of case that, for example, Dr. Greg Wilson has been involved in, and BTS also. From our filings in 2015, I believe it was, and perhaps a year or two before that, there is an affidavit from Dr. Greg Wilson stating that he has dealt on more than one occasion reunifying a sex offender in the family with the very victim or victims that have been historically the victims of that person. And yet still the goal was and the plan was reunification. Now, I don't know if those were Washington or Montana or Idaho cases, but those are the hardest cases, Dr. Wilson said, and this one is not in this category. I have nothing further, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Allender. Anything else, Mr. Thompson?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Well, in looking at this case, I'm left with the impression that probation and parole has been moving the goalposts from time to time. That has made it difficult for Mr. and Mrs. Sittler to comply with the edicts of the department. Um, I don't have an explanation for why the goalposts have moved. I don't have an understanding of why on one day it seems as if reunification is likely to occur, and that's the goal and the stated goal, and the next day it is not within the realm of possible. I haven't been presented evidence that I think suggests to me that Katie Sittler should not be reinstated, nor do I think I have been presented evidence that suggests that reunification should not be the goal. I think they should be the goal. If there were someone with the gravitas of Valley Treatment Specialties or Dr. Wilson saying, hold your horses, this is the wrong path to be on, I would be viewing this case much differently, but I don't have that evidence. All I have is the people that I think have expertise in this field saying, Katie Sittler has done what she needs to do to get reinstated, and reunification ought to be the goal, and that it would be both beneficial to the Sittlers personally and to society generally, because if he can be managed in a situation that reduces his likelihood to recidivate, that's the goal. And the experts told me that's what will happen if that occurs. I can't guarantee Stephen's son's safety. I'm not sure anyone can guarantee Stephen's son's safety. But the people that are most knowledgeable said in April that Katie Sittler should be reinstated and that the goal should be reunification. So I'm prepared to direct probation and parole to both reinstate Katie Sittler as a chaperone and to work with Valley Treatment Systems, Valley Treatment Specialties, and Dr. Wilson to accomplish reunification. How that goes, the specifics of that, I don't yet know. And I'm leaving that in probation and parole's control. I haven't seen the evidence to support Dave Sittler's reinstatement as a chaperone. That exists for Katie. So I'm denying that request at this juncture. I think we want to take it slowly. I think we're talking about baby steps. But I think the time has come to work in that direction. Is there anything else we need to take up?
Taking the easiest part first, two things. In connection with Mr. David Sittler, the briefing modified the motion for exactly the reason you pointed out. We don't have the evidence there. We requested in the, not in the motion, but in the briefing that P&P be ordered to show cause, say, in 60 days, why Dave Sittler not be reinstated. That might be a prompt to them to do whatever it is that they want to do, because they've done nothing since November 7th. That's the easiest of the two things.
Well, I don't know that I want to engage in that process that you've just described. I think it's incumbent on probation and parole to process chaperone requests, to identify criteria that need to be met, and to make a determination after that criteria has been met as to whether the chaperone is approved. And if there is a reason to question probation's determination, then I would be prepared to address that issue at that time. But as I said, one of the things that's concerning to me in reviewing this file is that it seems to be as if the goalposts are moving. I think this is a dynamic process. I can appreciate that. But I think it's probation and parole's obligation to sit down and say, these are the criteria. This is what has to be done. And if they are done, then we will make a determination at the conclusion of that, at the completion of those criteria, as to whether that is a sufficient basis. And then once that determination is made, then I can enter in and say, if it was contrary to David Sittler's recertification, I think he shouldn't be recertified. Or I can say, I think he should be recertified. But when Valley Treatment Specialties weighs in and says they think Katie Sittler should be a chaperone, I can gauge her affidavit. I can make a determination that there isn't anyone other than probation and parole saying that she shouldn't be recertified, that the criteria has been met for me to say she should be recertified. Now, whether she continues is a dynamic process. How things develop from here will determine her continuation in that way.
I understand, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Judge. This side of the table, the room will to wait for that action patiently. The other issue is your order in connection with the reinstatement of Katie. Is that effective presently?
I know of no reason not to do that presently.
Okay.
So, yes.
Under paragraph 14 of the court's consolidated order, it talks about line of sight. We have no fight with that. We have no quibble with that. We have no issue with that language.
Which also seems to be consistent with Valley Treatment Specialties April 29 letter.
I agree with you.
All right. April 29 was the date stamped in my office.
You're quite correct in that summary, yes. I wish I had said that myself. Nevertheless, the BTS letter also talks about the use of bathroom and so forth in nighttime hours. If Katie is indeed as Katie is indeed now ordered to be reinstated presently, at the very least, the family can have breakfast together and lunch together and dinner together under the line of sight and other restrictions and provisions. There remains Mr. Sittler has been living in a motel these approximately 11 months. There is a trailer on the premises where the house is of the Sittlers, and BTS contemplates Mr. Sittler actually sleeping in the home. We predict that P&P and perhaps even the court or others would think that's moving too fast. However, last August, September, whenever it was, he was leaving at a bedtime and going out to the trailer there at the home, therefore taking out of necessity renting the motel, yet providing an interim or middle way in between what now exists and full-fledged 24/7 living in the home. Am I right that I'm conceiving the line of sight requirement correctly, that at bedtime, at least presently, he would still be on the real estate premises but sleeping in the trailer unless a chaperone were present and awake?
I'd rather not get into the specifics of the implementation of my order. One of the things I try to say and do with from time to time is I don't try to micromanage probation and parole. And those details tend to be something that I am fearful that I would become a micromanager. And I don't want to become a micromanager.
I understand. Thank you.
Mr. Thompson?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm concerned that the defense may be confusing Mrs. Katie Sittler's reinstatement of the chaperone and reunification as being one and the same. And my understanding is clearly they are not.
They are not.
And Mr. Sittler cannot move from where he's living without probation agreement, consent. So he can't just unilaterally expect to move into some trailer on the backyard of the property.
I think that's correct.
And probation has expressed already a number of concerns about this particular residence, including a 6-foot-high solid wood fence that prevents public view of the premises itself.
I'm familiar with those.
So I just want to make sure that we aren't going to be back here in a week with the defense complaining that, oh, Mr. Sittler is not being allowed to immediately move back home because Katie is an approved chaperone.
I don't have any guarantee we won't be back here next week, but it's certainly my hope to not be back here next week.
I just want everything out up front here. I'm on that. The other question the state has, just for clarification, is on the provision that chaperones have to undergo polygraphs at their own expense. I just want to make sure that everybody understands that is a condition of being a chaperone, and the department can request that.
They may, but Katie Sittler's reinstatement is not contingent on her successful passage of a polygraph at this juncture.
And that's the clarification I was looking for. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Judge.
You're welcome. Anything else, Mr. Thompson?
The only other thing is the various motions to seal, and the state is prepared to rely on its response. We do not think blanket sealing of the submissions that are referred to is appropriate, but there certainly is sensitive information such as names of victims, names of chaperones, and then the psychosexual evaluations and polygraphs that we concede should be sealed.
So I'm going to seal the documents that were requested to be sealed. I'm convinced that there is confidential information contained in each of those as I reviewed them. My preference is not to seal documents, but I don't know how to craft a balance without redacting affidavits and going through a lot more work than has already been done in this case. So I'm granting the motion to seal. Anything else we need to take up?
I don't think so.
No, Judge.
We're in recess.